Well, well, well.
Well, well, welcome.
I feel like you've used that one before.
I have used it. But I have used it.
We're rolling with it just so the people know you're not original.
I'm not original, but I'm, I don't know what I am.
Here's the thing. I'm just going to bypass this awkward conversation and say I'm very excited for episode 8.
Episode 8 is so good.
Strong episode.
It's one of the best, I think.
I don't want to play favourites.
I always say that. You're all my favourites.
Yeah.
This might be
some people might be more favourite.
I think what this episode does is so perfectly capture the stuff that you and I are ranting and raving about all the time.
Let's kick it off. Let's get into it.
Your impatient week.
Well, look, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I feel like I start a lot of conversations with, here's the thing.
You're not very original. So.
Genetics. For those playing at home, have a mental health injury.
Mm-hmm.
Sustained at work.
Mm-hmm.
This means I've been through the delightful experience that is work cover.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people out there in impatient podcast land have done this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a fun time. But as a part of the process, there's a requirement that you get a certificate of capacity for work
mm-hmm.
from your doctor
mm-hmm.
the last 28 days.
Mm-hmm.
So once every 28 days, you're at your GP. Hello again, me again. And they tick three boxes, one of three boxes on a form. One of them says not fit for work of any kind,
mm-hmm.
fit for suitable duties or amend the work that they can do to make it appropriate and they can do it.
Yep.
Or fit for pre-employment duties.
Mm-hmm.
So pre-injury duties.
Yeah,
whatever you were doing before, you're good to go back.
You're good to go, yeah.
So I got a new job offer this week or 2 weeks ago or whenever that was.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And work asked me as a part of that process to go to the doctor,
mm-hmm.
get an updated certificate,
mm-hmm.
tick the top box.
Mm-hmm.
And I had literally been at my doctor 3 days prior to get my new 28-day certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So I made another appointment.
Mm-hmm.
We're good mates, me and my doctor.
Yeah.
Swindle. I see him more than pretty much any other person. Other than Carly, that's it. It's me.
You and the GP. That's it.
We're hanging out. Yep. Social visits once a month.
Yeah.
Took the form into him and we sat down together and read the top box, which said suitable for pre-injury employment, which I am not.
Not? Yep.
And so had to wade through, what do we do? Are they not going to let me have this job, which is nothing like the job that I was doing?
Yeah.
Because I haven't ticked the box or, what's the workaround here and why does it have to be
that way?
This way? Why do I have to, it's been complicated.
Yeah. And people wouldn't necessarily have any experience of work cover. I certainly don't. But, you and I speak often about this kind of continuum of health, and this kind of idea that you're either sick or you're not.
Or not, yeah.
And in a workplace, you can kind of see that if someone was climbing a ladder and fell off and broke their ankle.
Yeah.
And we've gone through the process of repairing that physical broken ankle.
Mm-hmm.
And you've recovered to the point that now you can go back to work and get back up the ladder. Well, then, that's a really simple process and that's a healthy versus not.
Yep.
But in a mental health context, there's a continuum there, right?
It's a different game.
And it's not to say that there isn't for a broken ankle either because, maybe you sustain some lasting impact there and I don't want to throw anyone under the bus who's dealing with a broken ankle right now and saying, hang on a minute.
We've all got struggles.
I don't feel seen as a patient. But it's a very different continuum, right, that mental health continuum.
And I don't think mental health injuries were considered in the construction of the form.
Mm-hmm.
Or the process that plays along with the form.
Yep.
But interestingly, I don't think that patients were considered in this process either.
Mm-hmm.
So just throw that out there.
So room for improvement there.
That's a good way to put it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
No, thank you for hearing.
Over to me then.
Sure.
I'm wrapping you up. Look, it's fair to say I'd like to delve in deeper into some of your things, and maybe at some point in the future we will. Look, there's a lot I could talk about in terms of my inpatient week, because there's been a lot of friggin' things that have gone down for me in the last week. But what I want to do is share with the group that this week I Googled the word inpatient.
Mm.
And you would have thought that perhaps I would have done that as part of our, you know, marketing strategy when we were putting the podcast together. But no, it's taken me until episode 8.
Lead up to episode 8.
Yeah.
Let's have a look.
Let's see what does that mean? What we've gotten ourselves into here. Impatient, the Oxford Dictionary, because I'm classy.
are you bringing elitism into dictionaries? Is that what we're doing right now?
I don't know.
What's a not classy dictionary?
I don't know. Dictionary.com?
Oh, spicy. Yeah.
Is okay. it? No, I don't know.
Sure. So that's a very common dictionary.
It's, yeah, I'm about to get a whole lot of comments. Nicole is such an elitist cow, whatever, with her dictionary preferences.
Oxford.
No, I'm not an academic, right? But it feels like Oxford would produce a good dictionary and a good definition, and I like it, so I'm going with it, okay?
It's the one that fits our need.
Exactly. Yeah. Impatient, characterized as having or showing a tendency to be quickly irritated or provoked. That's point one. Point two, restlessly eager.
It just feels like, did you write that?
Exactly. It feels like the Oxford Dictionary has got it right.
The classy dictionary.
The classy dictionary has like just perfectly defined what impatient means to us at this podcast, right? Yeah. Like we're either, and generally in delivering this podcast, we're generally either having or showing a tendency to be quickly irritated or provoked, mostly me, or we're restlessly eager, trying to enact change, right? And so I want to bring my impatient experience of this week to my experience of working with the colorectal cancer registry that I work at, right? Yes. Now, I want people to try to stay with me on this because all of a sudden I'm dropping words that people are like, But basically, at a really high level, right, I'm working on a project and with a group of people, a group of like-minded medical professionals, and their peers, including patients, to try to capture the data, the outcomes of what happens in bowel cancer, right? So I think that many people would have the assumption that when they go get operated on or when they go have chemotherapy and when they get a result from that surgery and when we get an outcome from having a cancer treatment, that all of that information would be packaged up and kind of brought together and analyzed and assessed and understood. So that we actually understand what we're treating and when, what the results are, how patients are feeling, what the outcomes were. Are we curing cancer? What's actually happening?
And it's not?
Not. We don't do that. We don't capture that data. We don't learn those lessons.
I feel like we should capture that data.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that too. Yep. And once I realized that it wasn't happening, I found myself quite quickly feel this. So, you know, this goes to our discussion around second opinions all the time, right? If we had a set of data that we could call on to say, okay, I've had this opinion, but what's actually, how are people being treated? You know, how are people, if they've got a stage 3 cancer or a stage 4 cancer, what's the outcome? What are people being, you know, I've been told to have this chemotherapy. Was that the only chemotherapy available? What else are people with my condition being treated for? Like, as patients, that would be so empowering. I mean, as medical professionals, you would think that we should have that data, and they don't. They only can go to clinical trials, right? Because that's the robust, you know, science safe environment in which we test things and we can control the variables, right? So many purists in academia will say, yeah, but we can't go to registry data, which is just like a set of all, you know, a summary of all of the outcomes that people have experienced individually, because it's less meaningful because there are so many variables in a patient population that we can't control for. And there might have been other stuff that influenced what the outcome was, right? But I would still say, you know, if I was a patient weighing up, should I be treated by that, like that hospital over there or that hospital over there? Wouldn't it be cool if I could quote unquote Google or, you know, similar, the results of care at that hospital over there and see if it's better than that hospital over there.
Yeah.
You know, this hospital keeps people alive 3 years longer than that hospital does. Mm. So we need to capture that data, and we need to share that data, and we need to share it with medical professionals so we all improve, but we also need to share it with patients so they are empowered in their healthcare, right? Mm. And so that's the advocacy project that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And this week we achieved charity status, right? Which is like, for tax purposes, recognition of the entity as an independent entity that stands alone. So the binational colorectal cancer outcomes registry is now registered officially as a charity. So can now receive funds to grow and to capture this data and to produce the outcomes and actually allow us to do some of the work that I'm talking about here and actually learn some of the lessons from the cancer care that's being delivered in bowel cancer at the moment.
2 points.
Cool.
Point the first.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Like, that is truly, truly astounding and exciting and astonishing and all of those words. Like, I'm pumped.
Thanks. That's really cool. It's like I'm now a director of a charity.
That's unreal.
Yeah, it's exciting. Making it's super a exciting. Yeah.
Point the second.
Uh-huh.
I assume then.
Yep.
Putting you, at least for the time being, firmly in the restlessly eager category.
I am so restlessly eager. And it's that restlessly eagerness that's driven this, you know? Yeah. And yeah, I will then be provoked when someone says, oh, registry data isn't great in terms of, you know, decision making and kind of learning a lot. Then I will very kind of more showing a tendency to be quickly irritated or provoked, respond with, have you ever been a patient and don't you think your singular experience as a patient should be captured and compared and contrasted and provide some kind of input into what we're doing and the decisions we're making for other patients? Unfortunately, you don't learn that lesson until you are a patient.
Mm.
And with that, you have my impatient week.
But also with that, I feel like we have what is a delightful segue.
Isn't it though? Did you want to make that segue?
No, I thought you might.
Look. Look.
I'm looking. I don't know. I'm looking. Right now I'm looking.
All right. So this week we speak to he's a pretty cool cat, actually.
Pretty cool cat.
Pretty cool cat. Ben Bravery, he's a bowel cancer patient, but he is so much more. Get strap in. Well, today, Sean, we are very excited to be joined by Ben Bravery. Ben, welcome to the Impatient Podcast.
Thank you. It's awesome to be here today.
Can you tell us, please, how you became a patient?
I became a patient when I was 28 years old, and I had kind of had evolving gut troubles, let's call it, for about maybe somewhere around 4 or 5 months. And they started off pretty benign and pretty irregular. And then things like constipation and diarrhea and weight loss and night sweats, pain and bleeding from my bowel became really common. And I wasn't able to kind of put them off anymore. And I put them off mainly because I was young and I didn't think that I could get this kind of cancer, especially since I didn't have a family history of bowel cancer.
Yeah.
But also because I was 28 and building a business in Beijing and I was working in science and I was interested in giant pandas and deer and monkey because I was a zoologist. And I'd also just fallen in love with my now wife and we'd been together 5 months when I was diagnosed. And the last thing you want to talk about when you're getting to know someone on that level and when you're trying to be your sexiest is, you know, the diarrhea you had that morning or the blood in the toilet bowl or the fact that you've got to somehow explain away these night sweats and that you might get lightheaded and faint when you're out bike riding. So these things kind of chugged along. And then I was in Beijing and I needed to go back to Melbourne to get a new visa. And I called my mum before that trip and I explained what was happening and I explained it in full, mm-hmm. probably for the first time to any one person. Everyone had little bits of the story,
yeah.
but no one had the full story. It was just me and my own dread. Mm. And she very quickly said, Benjamin, and she only calls me that when I'm in trouble, you're having a colonoscopy.
Yep.
And I didn't know how she was going to organize it, but my mum loves colonoscopies. She is a huge fan of colonoscopies. She's had way too many for yep. no real reason mm-hmm. in the private sector.
Right.
And any kind of scan or x-ray anyone prescribes, whether it's a GP or a naturopath, she'll rush off and have it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying she's a hypochondriac, but she's close. And so she said, you're having a colonoscopy, and you know, her hypochondriasis this time actually saved my life.
Yeah.
Because she organized a referral for me. I landed. I did fasting and laxatives for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the colonoscopy. Before we went in, I took mum to the gastroenterologist and I was squeezing her hand really tightly. And he said, you know, do you have any questions? And I decided to be brave and say, well, you know, deep down, I'm really worried that this is something major, that I have cancer. Because all the Googling I'd done, when you Google blood in your poo or blood in the toilet bowl, two things come up. You're either going to die from cancer
yeah.
or you've got hemorrhoids and they can be fixed in 5 minutes. Mm. It's one extreme or the other.
Yeah.
And I was still in the hemorrhoid camp, but had a sneaking suspicion that something a bit more sinister was happening. And he was a very good doctor, a very good communicator. And he said to reassure me, oh, I think that's the last thing we'd be looking for. Mm-hmm. You're so young, you don't have a family history, you're otherwise really fit and healthy. And it was a very different conversation when I emerged from the scope.
Yeah.
So he had organized mum to be in the room with me to debrief. And it struck me as odd at the time that mum was in there. I remember thinking, you know, defensively, oh, I'm 28, I don't need my mum in the room.
Yeah.
And then the next immediate thought was, oh, shit. That means something really bad's about to happen. And he explained that he'd found a very large mass in the sigmoid colon, which is one of the last parts of the large bowel before the anus. And it was so big he couldn't get the scope through. He had to pull out the camera and then use a teeny tiny pediatric camera to get past it. Mm-hmm. And that explained the constipation and the diarrhea and the pain. And he got past it and there was just the one big mass. So that was the first little win. But he said it looked pretty bad. He couldn't say with 100% certainty that it was a cancer, but it had all the features of a cancer. And he'd taken some samples and sent them off. And he asked me if I wanted to look at it. He'd taken some photos.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, I saw this thing inside me that had, you know, been bubbling away. Doctors say somewhere between 5 and 10 years it takes for a little polyp, so a little pouch of the bowel wall, to become a tumor.
Yeah.
So it had been there a long time, but it hadn't been this angry for very long, and it was black and it was bleeding and it looked like rotten flesh. It just looked nothing like the beautiful bowel around it. And that was my first glimpse into the, you know, the horror of this thing inside me.
Mm.
And that was the conversation, I guess, where I became a cancer patient.
Wow. I love how you described the beautiful bowel.
The beautiful bowel, yeah, it's the first thing. Yeah. It's the first question I'm biased,
of course. Yeah. It's my bowel.
Glorious, beautiful. Peachy, beautiful bowel.
Bowel's really pretty. Bowel's really pretty under the camera. It's pink and it's color, you know, it's got mucus and it's nicely walled. It's anyway, now I'm a doctor, so I can say weird things like that.
This is going to that, back to that sexy talk you were talking about earlier. That's what this is.
Exactly, right? I'm all over it now.
So what did treatment look like for you?
Well, you know, as you know, when you are young and you get a cancer, the first question becomes, are we dealing with one tumor or multiple tumors?
Mm-hmm.
So I was numb really for that conversation. I wasn't really taking much in. Mum was. wonderfully. And things became very intense very quickly.
Yeah.
And in that consultation, the doctor started picking up the phone, calling hospitals around the area, kind of moving out geographically to find one with a spare CT machine to get me scanned that day.
Yeah.
I didn't understand the urgency. You know, I'd been living with this thing for years and it'd be causing me trouble for maybe 6 months. I didn't understand why I couldn't. This was a Friday afternoon and I didn't know why I couldn't have the weekend off. But he wanted a scan on that Friday, and I let him and mum do that. And I had to walk outside and call Sana, who was still in Beijing, and tell her that maybe there was a big tumor and that, you know, the life we thought we were living was going to change. So I went off and had that scan, and it showed just one big tumor, which was another little win, but it was big.
Yeah.
And treatment was going to go two ways. I went off to a surgeon to talk about cutting this thing out, and he was really optimistic, and I was captivated by that. It was seductive. It was a really quick plan. You know, he'd seen the CT scan and looked at the biopsy results. This was a few days after. We knew this was a bowel cancer now.
Yeah.
It looked like one on the CT. It looked like one in the camera, and the tissue sample had proven it was. So he was like, we'll do keyhole. We'll cut this thing out. You'll lose that bit of bowel. We'll stitch it back up. You may or may not need a little bit of chemo afterwards, but I don't think so. And we'll get you back to Beijing maybe in 6 to 8 weeks. And that was music to my ears. Mum and I basically danced out of that consultation, thinking that this big, scary thing I'd been dwelling on was going to be reasonably curable. And later that week, Mum was in her backyard and she was on the phone to one of my aunties. And I also have this problem where I'm very loud on the telephone. Our voice goes up unnaturally several octaves for some reason. It's like we're at a rock concert and we're just having a normal conversation about what they should get from the shops.
Yeah.
And so my mum was on the phone to my auntie, probably yelling, but just talking. And a neighbor had heard the story.
Yeah.
And ducked her head over the fence and said, oh, I think Ben should get a second opinion. I used to work at a cancer hospital and I think it'd be really good if they met Ben and they talked about what was going on.
Yeah.
And I really didn't want to because I had this plan. And I didn't really appreciate the value of a second opinion. I dissuaded Mum and she persuaded me out as a favor to the neighbor. So I rang up this cancer hospital, and the first phone call was amazing. There's a beautiful nurse I spoke to who just dripped warmth down the phone. You know, you could tell she was asking questions that she would have asked hundreds of times before, but it felt like it was the first time. And she was genuinely curious. And she said, oh, we better get you in for a consultation with the surgeon. And I went, oh, okay, all right. So we go and see this second surgeon, and they had a really different approach. So they weren't as, you know, kind of warm. They weren't as friendly. They're a bit more academic. And it wasn't what they said that bothered us. It's what they wouldn't say. They weren't going to be committed to a quick fix. And they wanted a lot more data before they committed to anything. And I didn't understand why. I still didn't understand why they were being so cautious. And I said, oh, you know, actually, doctor, this is a second opinion. And the consultation went sour then. this doctor, you know, and I still send Christmas cards. But at that time, he did not enjoy that he was the second opinion. And he actually, I think he used the phrase, you know, shopping around. That I was shopping around. Things were tense. And I had offended him. He'd offended me. I left that consult, and Mum, and you know, Mum and I didn't dance this time. We kind of shuffled out. Pessimistically. And then I had a choice to make. Whether I went with the first kind of keyhole, get in, get out, get back to China. Second surgeon at a big cancer hospital, lots of cancer experts, wanted an MRI, wanted to talk to a radiologist before they went anywhere near the bowel. And it seemed way more uncertain, seemed like it was going to blow out, seemed a bit scarier. But I decided for that approach because I liked the idea of all those experts under the one roof. You know, this hospital only did cancer. And I thought if you have to have this thing and you got to go somewhere, and I didn't know how long I was going to spend in hospital. I wanted to be around people that just cancer was their bread and butter. And so I chose that hospital, and that was the second time my life was saved because we did an MRI and it showed that the tumor was actually a little nastier than the CT scan had showed, and it had invaded or got very close to invading a few tissues down in the pelvis. Now, male pelvises are crammed full of anatomy. They're kind of packed tight. We don't have the wider pelvises of females because they are that way for babies, right? So all the anatomy is kind of squished in next to each other. And so this tumor had the opportunity to go through the bowel wall and then start to branch out. It still hadn't spread, but it was touching the bladder. It had detached itself to the rectum, another piece of bowel, and fused. It was very close to the machinery that gets, you know, sperm from the testicles up to the penis. So there was questions about whether I'd ever be able to have a child. And so things got infinitely more complex. And so what that meant was that I needed radiation first with chemotherapy at the same time. That went for about 6 weeks. And then he thought, there's no keyhole here. I need to go in and I need to open this wide up. So they did a massive laparotomy. So from the kind of the pubic bone up to the chest. They had a urologist in there, multiple surgeons, because they were worried about the bladder and all the other anatomy. And that operation was about 5 or 6 hours. I ended up with a bag for a year to collect poo, to let the rest of it heal. And then I started about 5 months of chemotherapy after that. So, you know, my 6 week treatment became 12 months. And at the end of that, I was blessed with blood clots in the lungs. And so I then went on to anticoagulant therapy for a little while, which delayed the bag getting reversed, but eventually it was reversed all up. That was maybe 18 months. And then I was kind of spat out the end as a quote unquote survivor.
Good. All right. Well, off you go then. On with life, right?
Exactly.
Good to go. Can I ask a question at this point? How many people throughout your treatment journey told you that you've got the perfect surname for a cancer patient?
It comes up quite a bit.
I can imagine it does. Well-intentioned nurses going, don't you have a great name for a patient?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I always feel like a phony because I'm not particularly brave. I don't, you know, and I'm really tall and I don't play basketball, and it feeds into this idea of what I should be. But anyway, I'm getting off topic.
I could just like when I was contemplating your cancer journey and your name, I could just picture as a patient myself the number of nurses who were just, you know, like a theatre nurse or whoever picking up a file and going, look at this name in this young man, and isn't he brave indeed? And like, just like I could just see it playing out again and again. And you're sitting there internally rolling your eyes and externally, it's the first time anyone's made that joke. Thanks very much.
Made it to a fake laugh.
That's right. Let's build the rapport. Thank you for your empathy. Very, very much.
Finger guns go a long way.
How would you characterize your time as a patient? You know, you had a science background. Did that empower you? Did you feel like you kind of had some awareness of what it was to be kind of in this process, or was that background not kind of even acknowledged at all? Did it play a part? How empowered did you feel as a patient?
I didn't feel very empowered. The science background came up sometimes, but not very often. And it was a different science. So I had some of the basic understanding, and I'd studied a lot about animals, so I knew some anatomy, but you know, I didn't know anything about cancer. And I certainly didn't know as much as anyone else involved in my care. So that kind of didn't help. Although it made me comfortable with, when it came time to research my own disease, it made me more comfortable with accessing papers and reading results tables and things like that. The system did a very good job of making me feel passive.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think back on it, you know, realistically, I couldn't have been in the driver's seat for lots of it, because a lot of it is other people doing things.
Yeah.
And it would be unrealistic for me to feel like I was in control all the time. But I don't think I felt in control much of the time at all, even opportunities where I may have had some control or felt some agency. I was frustrated for lots of it. And I'd never been sick before. I had had like a little appendix problem a year before, which is interesting, maybe related, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
That was in Beijing, and I'd had a quick surgery and I was out of hospital in a couple of days, but that was it. That was my full extent of ever being unwell.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never fractured anything, never spent time in hospital, never cared for people in hospital.
Yeah.
My family, relatively young, no one had died, no one had chronic diseases, no one else had cancer. So I had very little experience as a patient.
Yeah.
And that meant that I went in fairly blind to the world of the hospital and healthcare. And so most of the time I just felt like a bit of an observer, a confused observer.
And at a certain point, you decided that you should become more than a confused observer and actually perhaps take part in the system, and you made the decision to become a doctor. Can you pinpoint when that happened? Was it a snowballing thing? Was there a moment in your experience where you went, right, that's enough, I've got to join these ranks?
I'd love that origin story, but you know, I storm out of the consult and I'm
that's
like,
right.
I'll show
that's
you,
enough.
Surgeon. Yeah, I've had it. it was an accumulation of frustration with parts of my care. And I always feel really conflicted talking about this because I am so grateful. Mm. I had amazing treatments, world-class treatments, delivered by excellent brains who nailed my diagnosis, nailed my treatment at the right time, and I'm alive.
Yep.
And I have met many people along the way, young adults with cancer, particularly bowel cancer, who are not.
Mm.
And so I have a guilt about that as well.
Yeah.
I don't want to feel like I'm whinging about the system because it saved me.
Mm.
And so I feel conflicted when I think about the frustrations I had as a patient, but they are valid. And so some of the things that I noticed along the way, they just kind of built up. I kept a journal. I started a little blog. It was mainly about the science, but sometimes this emotional stuff, this touchy-feely stuff would creep in.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I realized that there was quite a bit to do to sort this healthcare business out.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to volunteer. And I got involved with some charities for young adults with cancer, did some volunteering work at the Cancer Council, and so started to give back that way and try and impact things. But then I realized that to really kind of make a difference, I had to get in it. And that was scary because I'd seen a lot of the people in it, and a lot of the time they weren't happy.
Yeah.
and they didn't look like they were doing the job they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was no aha moment. I remember maybe my fifth or sixth infusion after surgery. I was laying in hospital waiting to feel nauseated, and I was watching the chemo drip into my arm, and this idea just popped in. It hadn't been a traumatic day. I hadn't had a particularly bad encounter, but it just, you know, maybe you could do this.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could do this. And it went away. Because you have lots of crazy ideas on chemo, mainly because of the steroids.
That's a steroid. So, that's a dexamethasone talking. Crazy.
That's a dexamethasone. And then dexamethasone comes in again because a week later, I'm up at 2 a.m. I can't sleep.
Yeah.
Dex has got me wired. I'm having all these anxious thoughts and I'm pacing in the lounge room and I'm baking because that's what I did during the night.
Yeah.
And while I'm waiting for the banana bread, I go, oh, that's right. I thought about becoming a doctor.
Yeah.
And I go and sit down at my computer. And I Google, how do you become a doctor? Because I'm not from a medical family. My family is very working class.
Yep.
I was the second member to go to high school,
yep.
finish it, mm-hmm. and the first to go to university, right? So mm-hmm. I don't have this pedigree. And I Googled it and it looked like hard work.
Yeah.
And it looked like that, you know, when you read blogs and articles, it looked like people were mainly unhappy, basically confirming what I'd seen or observed as a patient.
Yeah.
I did practice the exam to get into medical school and it seemed ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was philosophy and poetry and physics yeah. and chemistry. There were no questions about medicine or doctoring.
Mm-hmm.
And I failed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that it was just not for me and I put it in the bin and I didn't think about it again for about 2 years.
Okay.
I went back to work after cancer, tried yeah. to get back to my old life. I rushed back to my old life
yeah.
and never took the time out to really appreciate what had changed inside me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was changing jobs because I was getting frustrated and sad and I wasn't living the life I wanted and I hadn't worked out why. So I took a year off.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically did the grieving that I should have done during my diagnosis and after my treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I emerged that this was what I wanted to do and that to actually change things, I had to go in and I had to go in with my eyes wide open because I didn't want to change. I wanted to hold on what it was about me
mm-hmm.
that inspired me to do this. I knew that was going to be hard. So I Googled again one day, how do you become a doctor? And that awful exam I'd sat closed the next day, so I registered.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And then I spent the next 2 months just studying physics, chemistry, and poetry.
Yeah.
And then I passed it and got into medical school.
Wow. That's amazing.
Unreal.
What a story. And did you, your experience as a med student, how much of the patient did you see in medical school? How much was the patient acknowledged as a person, other than, you know, here's the patient in the form of some path results or the patient in the form of, you know, imaging results? Or how much did we actually talk about the patient in med school?
I was horrified by yeah. how absent they were.
Yeah.
I expected patients to be involved in the education of doctors because that was the job.
Yeah.
But they're not really there. And when they're there, they're reduced to almost caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
But and when they're there in a clinical setting, there's a power difference that means it's not real teaching.
Mm-hmm.
It's really exploiting. It's a maybe a senior doctor walking around with a bunch of students to a patient's bedside.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been in a gown feeling sick, laying in hospital. I would never have felt like I was in a position to instruct anyone else about my body
yep.
or what I thought they should be asking me or how they're asking me those questions. And so it just felt like we were reinforcing the power difference between the well and the unwell.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't elevating patients as teachers. Now, some medical schools do this better than others, and mine tried, but mm-hmm. it didn't try until later. And so what I did in second year was I was running a little group for students that were interested in general practice. And I thought, we need to get patients here. We need to get them on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
And so I had this little committee and we got someone with type 1 diabetes to come in and talk to us. And I got someone with cystic fibrosis to come and talk to us and lay out all their tablets, you mm-hmm. know, and mm-hmm. show us, like, show the doctor, these are the tablets I take every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is it. And this is how much it costs.
Yeah.
Like the stuff that you don't get, you get taught, right? Like we get taught about lung function and transplant biology totally. And all that stuff, but yeah. you're going to see someone now.
Yeah.
And the disease groups, the patient organizations were so keen to send yeah. people in because they've trained patients in this stuff.
Yeah, totally.
They're ready to teach. Mm. They just need to be given the opportunity. But I had to run these sessions after hours because they weren't core curriculum.
Yeah.
And I had to bribe students with pizza. And even then, so poorly attended, right?
Yeah.
Because this stuff is not on the exam.
Yeah.
It's not rewarded.
Yeah.
It doesn't form part of the anatomy prize, the chemistry prize, mm-hmm. the science prize. It's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only is it absent from our learning, it's absent from the system that incentivizes us to be better.
Yeah.
I did see it though a couple of times, and I saw it towards the end of medical school. A psychiatrist brought in someone with schizophrenia and their mother. Mm-hmm. And they brought in someone with an eating disorder and their mother. Mm-hmm. And a neurologist brought in somebody suffering from Parkinson's disease and their wife. And there's something about the brain doctors, you know, the psychiatrists, neurologists, they get it. Like yeah. they know that it's storytelling, that there's an arc to someone's illness journey, and that that's how you cement the knowledge, because they understand people, right? They understand the mind.
Yeah.
And I was struck by these narratives. And this was the first time I'd seen teachers in doctors elevating the patient. They sat at the front of the lecture hall and they taught us.
Yeah.
And there was a power difference. There was less asymmetry, mm-hmm. and the person was elevated to a point where they were a giver of knowledge, and that knowledge was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done during core hours, but still a lot of students didn't come.
Really?
Because you can't study that stuff.
Yeah,
and
sure.
it's not going to be on the exam.
Yep.
So I went to med school thinking I needed to sort out healthcare, and I was frustrated as a patient.
Mm.
And then I got a whole new round of frustrations as a medical student because yep. I realized this side of the equation was broken.
Yep. But you didn't decide to fix med school, obviously. You've, at this point anyway, you've decided to continue on to being a doctor. How did you, where are you at now in terms of that learning journey? Because it's massive, as we know. Mm. And what did you choose? What's your specialty? What are you going to do?
I do want to tell you that, but I just need to jump on that point.
Yeah.
So as a med student, I did try and fix things.
I didn't. I'm sorry. I wasn't insinuating that you didn't. I was more like you didn't just stick around to, you know, just do academia.
Nicole's here to tell you to do more, Ben.
Yeah.
Do more.
No, but this is really important for you, Nicole, because the other thing that's missing from med school is cancer.
Yeah, completely.
So I was blown away how little it was covered.
Yeah.
And compared to some things like heart disease, which we study over and over and over again, the cancer is left in this kind of vacuum. Mm. And what I discovered when I started to look around in the research was that this was a known problem since the 90s.
Really?
That medical school doesn't teach cancer well and no one had fixed it.
Yeah.
And so I partnered with the College of Radiologists, the radiation oncologists, to survey Australian and New Zealand medical students to find out what they actually understood about cancer,
mm-hmm.
and how they rated it compared to other subjects that they learned. Because I was like, we're never going to fix it unless we understand what the problem's like now.
What we know, yeah.
Yeah, and what I found was since the 90s, it had gotten worse.
Really?
So cancer knowledge had declined in people going to hospitals as interns, right, as first-year doctors. They felt less confident. They had less contact with people with cancer and those in palliative care.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought odd things, like they thought that external beam radiation, so the kind of common radiation that people get for tumors, made patients radioactive.
Oh, great.
Right? That's kind of a really big thing to get wrong.
Totally.
Because if you don't go on and have any more training, and once you get out of med school, the core stuff's done.
Yeah.
What you learn then depends on where you end up. If you're telling a patient, be careful, that make you radioactive. You better hug your kids and you better not touch this surface. Like, that stuff's dangerous.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's a little bit about what I tried to fix at med school. But yes, now I'm a doctor.
Yeah.
And I am 4 years out of medical school and I'm currently training in psychiatry.
So kind of one of the aforementioned doctors who are looking at the brain and understand humans. Was that inevitable, do you think, because you had the for lack of a better word, empathy of what it was to be on the other side and so had to kind of dive into that human side? I mean, mostly I'm asking through self-interest because I'm like, why aren't you in oncology? I mean, we need oncology needs you.
No, I know. Yeah, it does. that's such a good question. And I get that question a lot. I went to med school to become an oncologist.
Yeah.
Right? I wanted to treat people with cancer and look after
them. What the hell happened, Ben? Come on.
Yeah. What happened was medical education.
Yeah.
And so what I was struck by was the way that medicine was taught,
mm-hmm.
first of all, it's archaic.
Yeah.
And it's hostile.
Yeah.
And I thought that the focus was on the wrong things And that, you know, you could still, people have this idea that if you focus on the whole person or the whole patient and you connect and you understand and you give time to listen and you educate families and you write down notes that they can understand and you make extra calls when you need to, that you're going to lose the medicine, right? You're going to lose the anatomy and the chemistry and the pharmacology, but you don't. You can add that into the brain.
Yeah.
It's not a trade-off, but the bulk of medicine has just focused on the biomedical stuff. The nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
And then they use the excuse that there's no time to do the other stuff. And so I got very cynical about the medical model. It wasn't what I thought it was.
Yeah.
But it made sense that when I'd seen patients and doctors and nurses in hospital.
Yeah.
And how I'd felt as a patient. Now it all made sense.
Yeah.
It all made sense.
Yeah.
And so I had to make a decision about where I gravitated and where I was going to do the most amount of good. Because I've got big plans, right?
Yeah.
Like, yes, my specialty is one thing, but I want to disrupt this place.
Yeah.
And I think the way to do that is to focus on the whole person and then understand the relationship between the doctor and the healthcare provider, patient, doctor, patient, nurse, doctor, nurse. And psychiatrists do a very good job of understanding relationships and understanding where people sit in space and time. They don't call it a doctor-patient relationship. They call it an alliance. And I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah.
I thought that was beautiful. And I thought, why isn't the rest of medicine doing this?
Yeah.
And they spend a long time when they're history taking, i.e. a patient might feel interrogated. We call it an interview. when you're being interrogated, they spend a lot of time on the fluffy stuff. You know, where'd you grow up? How do you feel about your relationships? Are you safe at home? How much do you spend on cigarettes a week? Like trying to understand the person and what's important to them. And so that was the best outlet for me right now. I don't have lived experience in mental illness. I have lived experience in cancer, but I've got lived experience as someone who's very sick. And I see very little difference between the mind and the body. And I'm all about breaking down that stigma because they are illnesses and they can be treated and they can be understood. So that's why I'm in psychiatry now. And psychiatrists think about things. They think about systems and habitat. And my ecosystem thinking as a zoologist means that I can think about the patient in situ. So where are they in the room? Why are they in a four-person room? Yeah. Why are they right next to the nurse's station? Why are we using fluorescent lights? No one can sleep with fluorescent lights. Why does the machine beep at that particularly annoying volume all night? Why are we frustrating them like this? Why are we putting the person who's crying out in pain all night next to the 25-year-old for a routine surgery? Like I'm thinking about the system and how we deliver healthcare in that system, and psychiatry sets me up for that.
I love it. And it's not, I guess, choosing a specialty is not the end point, right? It's not, okay, now you're in the channel and that's what you do. You know, you swim in the new lane and that's all you're capable of doing, you know? And I think so many people in even just because I speak to quite a lot of student doctors and I've spoken to one just this last week on the ward because I was in hospital. And she was wrestling with, oh, I don't know what to pick. I don't know what to pick. And I thought this and now I'm thinking this and I'm really torn about it. And it just seemed like a sort of an absolute choice, you know, if I choose this, then that's forever for me and I can't ever do anything else. And it sounds, the way that you describe it, it sounds much more, you kind of identify a core purpose and what you actually want to achieve, through having a career in medicine and then pursue that first. And if you're pursuing that core purpose, then, you know, is the choice of discipline or specialty as critical? I don't know. It's an interesting thing to consider, isn't it?
That's really interesting. And did you present that reframe?
I did. I presented a lot of things. She was in my room for about 25 minutes because I was like, student doctor.
How lucky was she?
These are the ones I really want to talk to. So
absolutely. Get them young.
That's right. Exactly. And I did also say to her, oncology needs you. Like, come on. This is where we need the people. I think she was more convinced, I think, going through that conversation that maybe oncology is a good choice than she was when she walked into the room. Sean, I want to give you a space to ask a question because I'm just like, but what about this? And I'm going to spend this. And what about this?
We're very much in your wheelhouse here, and I'm aware of it. Happy to let you run, but I do want to ask you, Ben, because I got to get one in while I can. You said before, talking about second opinions and systemic issues, that you talked about guilt. I'm always fascinated by mental health and mental the psychology of stuff. You said that the system saved you, but I feel like, and I don't want to be pushy on it, but I feel like the second opinion saved you. And failing the second opinion, your outcome probably would have been quite different. And something we preach a lot about, and a lot of people have talked about on this show with us, is the importance of second opinions. And yet the mindset, it seems to me, of the professionals working in this industry is that that's shopping around, quote unquote.
And I'd love disrespectful.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Where it seems to me it's the thing that saved your life.
There's a lot there in that question. It's such a good question because, you know, the idea that doctors are the gatekeepers of knowledge, which is traditionally what it's been, that's eroding, and that's a good thing. You know, in the 2.0 age, it can no longer be the position that's where your status, your currency is, because people have, and they should have, access to a whole range of other forms of knowledge, other forms of information. But what I saw in my colleagues is that as you learn more, you're really, really at risk of getting an ego.
Yeah.
Because you're in a club, you know, the club is self-reinforcing, and it's, the stuff you learn is cool. It sometimes it can feel like a superpower, you know, like your understanding of the human body and your ability to fix it.
Yeah.
And medicine is incredible. Like, it's incredible skill set. But they're just people with those skills. They're just people with that knowledge. And a lot of medicine is smoke and mirrors, you know, it's charades, because there's the big oak desk, and there's the, you know, there's the waiting list, and then there's the very expensive fees often to get a consult. All those things accumulate to this idea that the person sitting in front of you is all you need. And we've engineered the system that way. And doctors are a trusted source of information in the community, and that's a great thing. But they shouldn't be the only one. And so I think there's a lot in what you're saying there about second opinions. And really, you've got to be humble about it, because the person in front of you, when you're sitting as a doctor, the person in front of you is also a person. And it's like buying a TV or researching a new car or looking at, you know, resorts in Fiji. You look around and you look at what other people think. Like, totally. It's completely natural to do that. And it should be encouraged. I tell all my patients, go and get a second opinion, and don't stop there. If you have the means, get a third one, and bring in the paper that you've printed off from the internet. Bring me in the blog about the person with lived experience that has a treatment that you want to talk about. Let's have the conversation, because my skill is translating that space between all the medical knowledge I've inherited and your life. That's how I see my job, right? I'm not the expert in the disease. I'm an expert in how to translate that information to the person in front of me.
Yeah. And in doing so, you become an advocate for your patient just naturally, right? Because
totally.
They're the kind of the most important person in the room while your focus is on them, right?
Totally.
So my next question is, how do we make sure we keep you there and you don't get sucked in to the status quo and become like the rest of them? How do you check yourself on that? How are you managing that?
Yeah, awesome. So I'll be super honest, it's hard.
Yeah.
And there were parts of med school where I wasn't me. And I was losing the authentic me. And I was starting to think like a doctor. And I could feel it, you know, my mum would call me out with a new symptom and I'd start to ask the history questions that we learn to ask, and I'd get frustrated that she wasn't giving me the answers I wanted, right? Just stick to the script. Give me what I want. I'm busy. And then, you know, you're on, you know, my current job is quite busy and it might be 6 p.m. I've got a 2-year-old at home. And, but like that person's mum, that patient's mum really needs to hear from me today. Like they're desperate and I've got to choose. I've got to choose. It's hard to be the doctor I want to be. Fundamentally though, I go to work as a patient wearing a stethoscope. So I can't lose the part of me that knows what it's like to be unwell. And the part of me that knows what it's like to have all your belongings taken off you and get it replaced with a gown that doesn't fit and an ID band and to lay in a hospital bed and not be able to look at your file and to have the medications you're told you're having, whether you want them or not. I feel it. And so I hope that it informs my everyday interaction. The problem I have with that is we've got to scale this experience up. So I can't wait for every doctor to get sick. And all of a sudden realize what it's like.
I say this and all the time. I can't wish illness upon you. Like there has to be another part.
I don't want that. Don't want that.
Yeah.
And there are beautiful books written by doctors who have done that, who have become sick and realized that what they were doing was wrong. That's too late. That's too late. I've got ideas around how medical students should be selected. I've got ideas around how patients should be elevated in our education process. I've got ideas around how to diffuse some of the hostility in the transmission of medical knowledge from the older generations to the next generation. And then once you hit the wards, I've got lots of ideas around how to roster and how to accommodate humans working in a system treating other humans. So I think about these things all the time. You know, the way I keep who I am is by reflecting. So I do that actively. Like sometimes journal, or sometimes voice record. I wrote a book. That helped.
You wrote a book.
that helped me put, that helped me put all my ideas down at this point in my career. And, you know, there's comments online already saying you're too young to be writing this. I'm not young, I'm 40, but you're too junior. We love that term, too junior. You don't understand the system. You don't understand the complexity. But it's precisely now in my training that I should be asking these questions.
Completely.
Because once I've crossed over and I'm earning big paychecks and I've got, you know, my practice set up, I will forget all this trauma and I will just reinforce the status quo.
It'll be happy days. So your book, The Patient Doctor, is dropping imminently. I cannot wait. Cannot wait to read it.
My pre-order is in. I'm excited.
We are.
Oh, thank you.
We are psyched. Was that why you decided to write the book? Because you needed to do this now? It was a an action that you could take to affect change in a sort of a different way?
Yes, but it wasn't my idea. So I actually, on my first day as a doctor, I got allocated oncology because I wanted it. And the night before, I just was laying in bed completely panicked that I'd done the wrong thing and that the system was too mean and that I was going to kill people. And so I, you know, anxiously tweeted, I'm starting on oncology ward tomorrow. I was a cancer patient less than a few years ago. I'm freaking out. And it went kind of viral and thousands and thousands and thousands of likes. And a publisher saw it and said, oh, this is an interesting perspective. And I had done some writing for the ABC on patient-doctor communication and my niggles with the system and being bullied because I didn't escape medical school without being bullied. I'd written about these things and they've kind of said there's a thing here that needs to be told and you could be the person that do it. And it felt right because I'd been writing and journaling on this stuff, but I was waiting. I was waiting until I had a bit more status. Because, you know, as a doctor, once you put yourself out there, you're only as good as your knowledge. You're only as good as your last exam performance. And you've got to be at the top of the game for the others to listen to you.
Or the journal articles you published.
Which mean nothing at the end of the day. And so,
big call, Ben. Big call.
So the publisher gave me some confidence. My wife helped a lot in that space. She's like, this is perfect. This is the stuff you're always ranting at me about.
Why you can just write it down.
And so it felt like now was the right time.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. And when you, I'm interested to just pick up on this idea of being bullied. Are you bullied because your ideas are too different, or because you're too junior, or because you're too vocal? What's the sort of root cause of that?
There was nothing about me. The bully didn't know me actually at all.
Okay.
They hadn't looked at my CV. I don't actually think they knew my name. They came up with some other name for me. During that placement, I think most of the bullying comes about because of the personalities that are selected and then the way they're rewarded
mm-hmm.
in medicine, and that, you know, that embodied power that we've given a lot of doctors
mm-hmm.
and we've given them power over other people, and we've given them power over spaces like hospital spaces are really designed for them. And you know, there are other people that know much more about bullying to explain why it happens. But interestingly, that person knew nothing about me, and they probably should have, because they were bullying someone that had written about the attitudes of senior doctors.
Of medical professionals, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, maybe Nicole, maybe they had.
Yeah.
You know, but they never told me that.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. It just felt like I needed to be pulled down.
Yeah, because you're different. Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know the things they were asking me. So there's this amazing thing in medicine where you're open to being questioned about what you know all the time.
Sure.
At any time.
Yeah.
And I'd rocked up, and my supervisor, who was already a, you know, dysregulated person, had sent me off to this other doctor.
Mm.
And that doctor decided that they were just going to quiz me on this stuff that was completely unrelated.
Sure, okay.
Not only to what we were doing, but to medicine. And when I started to get the answers wrong, they became increasingly motivated.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Any other questions from you?
No, I'm keen for your
my rap question.
I love this question.
But
so
I keep
much.
Forgetting.
Yeah. Bring it back.
Bring it back.
The people want it back.
The people want this question back.
Yeah.
This is a question that we ask all of our guests when I remember to ask it, which is, from your perspective and your experience, can you tell us in the health system something that is working, something that is broken, and something that everyone in the system needs to hear right now?
So They're big questions, and you guys know that. That's why you ask them. So the broken question, I think one of the main things for me is that patients enter a hospital and it's like they go back a couple of decades
mm-hmm.
and they go into an information void. They go into a certainty void. They get stripped of their identity, and they're really basic things that we could fix.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be that way. And I think a lot of the relationship is set up to fail
mm-hmm.
because of that. That's a big broken thing. And the health system has resisted innovation in this space.
Yes.
Resisted it wholeheartedly.
Yes. Yep.
And so that's a big broken thing for me.
Yep. Love it. Is something working? Anything?
Yes. What's working is that the system... The system is double-edged. the system, so I'm cheating, but the system is built to exploit the humanity of the healthcare workers left.
Uh-huh.
And that actually works, but it's not sustainable.
Yeah.
So we saw it in COVID. I wrote my book before the pandemic, but it's just front page news every day now.
Completely.
The kindness and the commitment and the compassion of the people in the system is being exploited.
Yeah.
And it works because it keeps the system just functioning.
Yeah.
And it stops people dying mostly.
Yeah.
But it ain't going to work for long.
There is a limit, isn't there?
Yeah. And I think we're close.
Yeah. I would completely agree with that. And something that everyone in the system needs to hear right now.
We're all people. We're all just people. Like, strip the labels.
Yeah.
Take off the gown, but make sure you're wearing something underneath.
Yeah.
remove the tie from the doctor. Take off the ID badge. We're just two humans, and we're engaged in a mutual thing.
Yeah.
It's a mutual thing. I need them, they need me. And it's a beautiful mutualism, and it's odd and it's special because it doesn't exist in many other places.
Yeah.
But all systems depend, all parts of the system depend on each other.
Yeah.
And I wrote the book because I wanted both sides of that relationship, doctor-patient, nurse-patient, doctor-nurse, all of them, to better understand each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because the system kind of relies on them being split and angry at each other.
Yeah.
Because in that space, it doesn't have to change.
That's right.
And the more they understand about each other, the more aligned they'll be. And as allies, the system has got to get better. It's got to.
Powerful. Yeah, yeah, completely agree. Oh, such a great conversation.
Such a great conversation.
I cannot wait for your book, The Patient Doctor, which is where? Available from amazing bookstores near you, should we say that?
Nearly everywhere.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
Nearly everywhere.
Yeah, I can't wait. I will be fangirling all over the place once that's actually in, you know, in bookstores. So it's so exciting. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So nice to chat to you, mate. Thank you.
Well, that was quite a conversation.
What a conversation.
There are so many things I want to talk about. In summary, I guess.
Right. Key takeaways. Let's do it.
Well, look, I think one of the things that really stands out for me, and it's something that we've spoken about, our guests have spoken about, is this idea that we need individuals in the system to make sure the system functions.
Yeah.
The way that Ben characterizes it in terms of what's working, I don't want to preempt what's most depressing to you. Because I know you'll give me that.
Let me ask. Are we there? Is this what's most depressing to you?
Maybe.
Wow.
Maybe.
Welcome.
And it's nice to be here. But when you characterize something as working in the system, of course, with this double-edged sword of what it is exploiting the individuals who care.
Yeah.
Right? It's the fact that, you know, a nurse will work overtime, you know, or stay longer or skip a tea break or, you know, it's the system taking advantage of those things that allows this system to function effectively.
Yeah.
Pretty depressing.
Yeah, I mean, that's up there.
Mm. Did you have anything more depressing you wanted to?
I don't know that I have anything more depressing.
Mm-hmm.
But the most, well, maybe this, okay, this isn't making any sense whatsoever. Whatever. The most depressing thing for me comes to the second opinion stuff.
Yeah.
That we talk about and I feel like we beat the drum about like a lot.
All the time.
That's important.
It is.
But that Ben went into the system and got spat out the other side and says through guilt, the system saved me.
Yeah.
When the outcome for him would be so vastly different had he not gone for that second opinion.
Yep.
Is sad.
Yeah.
And even his doctor that he ultimately went with that ultimately saved his life told him he was shopping around.
Yeah.
Like, come on, man.
It was really his mum's loud voice and the nosy neighbour
saved him.
Totally.
We have to be okay with the fact that people need second opinions. It should be part of the process.
Yep.
We should be comfortable with it as physicians and as patients. Like, it's important.
It's really important. But when you use that word alliance as well.
Oh, so beautiful.
Yeah. Like when we are allied
in
what we're trying to work on here, which is the outcome for the patient, well, then it really makes sense to get a second opinion, right? It really makes sense. Like everyone medically in their career is going to have a different set of experiences, right? Mm. And the value comes in the cross-section of that experience.
Yep.
And doctors know that because they'll take things to a multidisciplinary team meeting, right, and seek the opinions of their colleagues. But it's this idea that, you know, it's only them who can do that, you know.
Yeah.
And a patient is not allowed to do that.
We do that.
Yeah, that's right. We seek the opinions that we want to seek and then we'll tell you what you need to know. And that's not right, you know. If patients are allies, if patients are equal, and if we're actually working towards the outcome for the patient, well, then we're all doing that as a collaboration.
Mm.
And that should be not just accepted but really championed by the system. And with that.
And with that.
Ben has written a book. It is called The Patient Doctor.
Mine's pre-ordered.
Oh.
Although you've just informed me that I could have pre-ordered it from a store that would have been a signed copy.
Yeah.
And I didn't do that.
You could do that too.
So I'm going to reach out to Ben.
Well, let's call this a reach out to Ben. We would actually like a signed, personalised copy. Like, I want, dear Nicole, my participation in the Impatient podcast was one of the
best experiences of my life.
Of my
I only wish it had happened before the book. It would have been a chapter in its own right.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So we like something like that, yeah. I think.
I don't think we're asking too much.
I'm happy to still pay for the book. I just want the personalisation.
Yeah. I don't disagree.
Yeah. I'm not, I mean, I don't think I'm asking for too much.
No, nor do I.
But I do think we need to say thank you to Ben for participating.
I'm wondering if we can get a shout out in the second book.
Oh, yeah.
This one going out to Sean and Nicole.
Yeah.
Obviously leading the way, really making a difference in the world.
We are all rogue agents together. Shout out, fam. Yep.
No, Ben, strong thank you, particularly giving up a weekend day to record.
Yeah,
to us.
He did. A weekend, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's all.
That's
so thanks for listening. Hopefully we've made a slightly shorter podcast this week, but I don't know if we have.
Very much doubt that.
So thanks for listening.
All the way
yep.
to this point.
Yep.
Which is the end.